As we approach Consecration Sunday next week, I wanted to talk about stewardship and how we take care of people. One way that churches have taken care of people for thousands of years is with food. Church and food just go together. There aren't too many church events that don't involve food. Which brings us to our second reading from 1 Corinthians chapter 8, verses 1 through 13. As to the eating of food offered to idols, we know that no idol in the world really exists, and that there is no God but one. It is not everyone, however, who has this knowledge. Since some have become so accustomed to idols until now, they still think of the food they eat as food offered to an idol, and their conscience is defiled. But we are no worse off if we do not eat, and no better off if we do. But take care that this liberty of yours does not somehow become a stumbling block. For if others see you, who possess knowledge, eating in the temple of an idol, might they not be encouraged to the point of eating food sacrificed to idols? So by your knowledge, those believers are destroyed. When you thus sin against members of your family and wound their conscience, you sin against Christ. Therefore, if food is a cause of their falling, I will never eat meat, so that I may not cause one of them to fall. This is the word of the Lord. So this is a really weird passage because it's giving very specific advice to a very specific group of people living out their faith in the middle of a very specific cultural practice. In the city of Corinth at the time Paul wrote this letter, if you went to buy meat at the market, virtually all of it would have been consecrated to false gods, or parts of the animals would have been sacrificed before the rest were put up for sales. Since the very first one of the Ten Commandments is to have no other small g gods, but to only worship the one true capital G God, a lot of people felt that to eat meat sacrificed to pagan idols was a sin, because it broke the first commandment. But Paul knows that these other small g gods don't exist. Of course they don't exist. If you believe in one single creator God who rules over every atom of creation, then by definition, there are no other gods. To Paul, it doesn't matter that meat was blessed in the name of the god of fire, or the goddess of the hearth, or the god of the bean market, because it shouldn't mean anything if food is blessed to something imaginary. And yes, even though Koumites never existed as a real god, the ancient Athenians really did worship a god of the bean market. Okay, so fake gods are fake, obviously. So logically, if food has been sacrificed to them, it shouldn't matter, right? Paul doesn't say that this statement is not true, but he wants to affirm that respecting one's conscience is more true. Say two early Christian friends are at a dinner party. One says to the other, "You know, our host blessed this food in the name of the god of the bean market. Isn't it silly to have a god of the bean market? I hope that someday they come to know the one true God." These things are true. But the second friend is struck speechless. He doesn't want to participate in a meal that honors false gods. One of the ways the second friend lives out his faith is by avoiding food sacrificed to idols as a way to obey the Ten Commandments. It's really important to him. But now the first friend is telling him that his spiritual practice and his conscience don't matter. How can he feel comfortable eating with his friend again? What if this friend invited him to dinner and didn't tell him where the food came from? These things are true too. Both friends are honoring God and following their consciences. Even though the first friend sees nothing wrong with eating the food blessed to the god of the bean market, perhaps the most appropriate thing to do would be to say, "You know what, let's forget the meat and just have dessert instead. And tell me more about your sister's baptism." By skipping the meat together, both friends avoid going against their conscience, and the first friend can help build up the faith of the second. But most of us will never be served any kind of food that has been sacrificed to a false god, because that is not the kind of society that we live in. Paul's point about respecting the needs of others still stands, though. As you all know, Halloween is my very favorite holiday. My first year at seminary, I made cards and gave out candy to all the ladies in my hall, and I was really looking forward to the Halloween party in one of the other dorms. One day, I said as much to my friend Becca and asked what she was dressing up as. She said she wasn't. What? I got very indignant and was about to accuse her of having no sense of fun or whimsy or creativity, but then she told me a story. When she was 6 years old, Becca was diagnosed with diabetes. All of her memories of Halloween as a kid involve seeing everyone else having a great time, while she wasn't allowed to participate. And if she did, all her candy was taken away. There's nothing wrong with me celebrating Hallowtide and being enthusiastic about costumes, but it's more important to affirm my friend's right to be included. Whenever I pass out Halloween candy, I always participate in the Teal Pumpkin Project, which means that parents know I'm giving out something that's safe for tiny diabetics or little kids with food allergies. Last year, I taped a teal paper pumpkin to the door and handed out glow sticks and paper airplane kits. Imagine being a little kid whose treats are taken away at every celebration. Or imagine how hard it would be to move to a new community and navigate a church potluck if you had a restrictive diet or food allergies but didn't know what was in each dish. Imagine having a dinner party with new friends who didn't know that you're a recovering alcoholic and who put a glass of wine in your hand as soon as they took your coat. Imagine being in recovery from an eating disorder and not feeling comfortable sharing meals with strangers. What church events would be left? Imagine if you had celiac disease and even communion made you sick. Imagine if you had severe asthma and couldn't attend church on Easter because the flowers made your throat close up. Imagine joining a church and wanting to be known as Aaron, who illustrates children's books and loves the Beatles, and not as, "Oh, shoot, Aaron's here today. We can't put out the pecan pie bars." Imagine joining a church and being asked the rather invasive question, "Well, what would happen if you ate something you're allergic to?" And not being asked, "So what are you passionate about?" There's nothing wrong with treats or potlucks or communion bread or wine or shared meals or Easter lilies, but it's more important to celebrate childhood. It's more important to make strangers feel safe and welcomed. It's more important to affirm difficult recoveries and people's life choices. It's more important to not risk killing people who come to church to hear the gospel. Whenever I join a new community, I try to start a culture of labeling food at potlucks. You might have noticed last week that I'd printed up a bunch of cards with a line for the name of the dish, the name of the person who brought it, and a word bank to circle some of the most common food allergies. It can be hard to know exactly what's in a casserole, and it can be a lot easier to skip over most of the table rather than figure out who made what and whether it's something you're able to eat. There's nothing wrong with any dish that you've brought to share, but it's important to keep the table open to everyone so that we can all eat together with old friends and with new faces, and also with me.